This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, the 1st of February, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, President Obama announces plans to extend mortgage relief to struggling homeowners, but a government budget study paints a bleak picture of what's to come. And as budget cuts hit schools across the country, high school students in New York walk out to protest closures. And we'll go to the Philippines, where an historic impeachment trial is testing the government's pledge to root out corruption. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. The Republican-controlled Indiana Senate today passed a right-to-work bill. Under the legislation, workers who choose not to join unions will still be able to reap the benefits of collective bargaining without having to pay basic union fees. Hundreds of protesters crowded the Capitol today. They have vowed to protest the Super Bowl, happening in Indianapolis this Sunday. The Indiana governor has promised to sign the legislation into law. Yesterday, presidential candidate Mitt Romney won the Republican primary in Florida, and with it, all of the state's 50 delegates. He would have won 100 delegates, but the Republican National Committee penalized the state for holding its elections early. Now a Latino group is suing the RNC to restore the lost delegates. FSRN's Janelle Irwin reports a favorable outcome in the case could reshape the way primary schedules are created in future elections.
Attorney Michael Steinberg represents the Hillsborough Hispanic Coalition. He claims the current schedule for presidential primaries is discriminatory toward Latinos, because the states that are allowed to hold their elections early don't have a significant Latino population.
We have a problem with them saying Iowa, New Hampshire, South Dakota, North Dakota, Wyoming, Montana, you go first because you don't have a lot of Hispanics and blacks in your electorate, and all the other states have to go after you so that we already know who the nominee is going to be after the first six primaries.
The case is expected to be heard within 6 weeks, and a ruling could come as soon as June. However, Steinberg says it's also likely a decision won't be made until after the August convention. If that happens, the lawsuit wants the RNC to include states with Latino populations near the national average in the early primaries of 2016. Steinberg filed and lost a similar case against the Democratic National Committee in 2008. Janelle Irwin, FSRN, Tampa.
The Susan G. Komen Breast Cancer Charity has cut ties with Planned Parenthood, and many suspect the charity did so because of pressure by anti-abortion groups. Komen has also recently hired an anti-abortion former gubernatorial candidate from Georgia named Karen Handel to become its head of public policy. Handel promised to eliminate state funding for Planned Parenthood during her campaign. Komen is reportedly pulling hundreds of thousands of dollars in grant funding that Planned Parenthood used to provide low-cost breast cancer screening. Komen cites a recent policy change requiring them to cut funding to the family planning nonprofit because of an ongoing congressional investigation. That investigation, being headed by an anti-abortion Republican, is being called a sham by many progressive groups. Activists and workers rallied in New York City today to demand an investigation into the arrest of Chinese taxi drivers. The arrests came after the drivers complained about unfair labor practices by their employer. FSRN's Salim Rizvi reports from the protest.
The protesters alleged that for more than a decade, drivers worked up to 16 hours a day without wages and were forced to pay the Yes Car Service weekly fees to work. In 2010, 20 drivers filed a complaint with the New York State Department of Labor, which awarded unemployment insurance to one driver. The owner appealed the decision. Since then, the drivers complained that agents from the U.S. Department of Labor and U.S. Attorney's Office have been visiting their homes and harassing them. According to the advocacy group Justice Will Be Served, federal agents arrested three limousine drivers on harassment and other charges. Josephine Lee is with the campaign.
Very same agents not only arrested these three drivers, they arrested five other drivers who have nothing to do with the unemployment case, nothing to do with the New York State Department of Labor. They arrested five other drivers because they only complained and to the government and because they exposed the legal practices of the Yes Car Service company.
The group wants U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder to intervene. They have planned another rally for March 1 if their demands are not met. Salim Rizvi, FSR in New York City.
Thousands of people converged in Dakar, Senegal Tuesday to protest President Abdoulaye Wade's bid for a third term in office. Opposition parties say his candidacy is a violation of the country's constitution, which only allows two terms. FSRN's Alpha Jallo reports from the capital.
A traffic jam in the capital delayed the start of Tuesday's rally, which was organized by the June 23rd movement and supported by most opposition parties. The opposition denounced the ruling of the Constitutional Court clearing the president to run again. They said that the court would be held responsible for the blood that has been spilled, a reference to the five people killed so far in anti-war protests. Former UN diplomat Ibrahim Afal blamed the government for the violence.
I don't believe that our peaceful demonstrations have resulted in violence. It is the repression by the police and other forces of this government that has been the reason of violence.
As the protests continue into the evening, at least one more person was killed by a police truck. Elections are scheduled on the 26th of February. Alpha Jallo, Free Speech Radio News, Dakar, Senegal.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. President Barack Obama unveiled new plans today to help struggling homeowners pay their mortgages and avoid foreclosure. The announcement comes a day after the Congressional Budget Office released its Economic Outlook study, which predicts many more years of high unemployment, low consumer confidence, and many tough policy choices ahead. FSRN's Alice Olstein has the details in Washington, D.C.
Millions of families across the country have lost their homes since the housing bubble burst in 2008, and millions more are at risk of foreclosure. During a speech in Falls Church Wednesday morning, President Obama outlined several initiatives he says address this crisis and restore fairness and responsibility to the housing market.
It is wrong for anybody to suggest that the only option for struggling responsible homeowners is to sit and wait for the housing market to hit bottom. I refuse to accept that, and so do the American people.
The proposed policies let struggling homeowners refinance their mortgages at lower rates, saving each family about $3,000 a year. The president also called for simplification of mortgage forms so there are fewer hidden fees, and a program to convert foreclosed homes to rental properties. The president would like to pay for all of this with a financial transaction tax, a small tax on Wall Street stock and asset trading that the Center for Economic Policy Research estimates could raise more than $100 billion per year. Peggy Mears, a homeowner advocate in Los Angeles, supports the president's proposals, especially the simplification of mortgage contracts, but says the government must prioritize helping those on the brink of foreclosure.
We expect for our elected officials to work with us to keep people in their homes. And if they can't work with us, then we'll have to take them out of office and put someone in that's going to work with the people, for the people, by the people.
Many politicians and economists point to the housing crisis as both the cause of the recession and the biggest obstacle to economic recovery. Andrew Fieldhouse with the Economic Policy Institute says the ideas proposed by the president, especially the refinancing initiative, would do a great deal for economic recovery.
A lot of these proposals make a lot of sense. If you manage to lower someone's interest rate in their monthly payment, they have more disposable income to spend on other goods.
Housing is just one of many issues outlined in the Congressional Budget Office's most recent Economic Outlook study, which they released earlier this week. According to the CBO's projections, unemployment may top 9% this year and won't drop below 6% until 2017. At a hearing Wednesday morning, Wisconsin Republican Paul Ryan attributed the disappointing jobs outlook to a failure of President Obama's economic policies. But his Democratic colleagues on the Budget Committee, including Maryland's Chris Van Hollen, drew different conclusions.
The fact is that the CBO said that the Recovery Act helped save or create up to 3 million jobs in the year 2010, compared to what it would have done if the Congress had not taken action.
Committee Democrats also questioned CBO Director Douglas Elmendorf on the effects of the Bush-era tax breaks for the wealthy.
Extending those expiring tax cuts for a few years provides a boost to the economy during those few years, but will, by the end of the decade and beyond, be a drag on GDP because the effects of the accumulating debt outweigh the beneficial effects of lower tax rates.
After hashing out the details of the report, Elmendorf told the committee that the government will soon be faced with a fundamental choice.
Policymakers will need to allow federal revenues to increase to a much higher percentage of GDP or make very large changes to Social Security and federal health care programs.
In other words, scrap the Bush tax cuts or slash programs that millions depend on. Fieldhouse put the question in different terms.
If people don't want to pay taxes, you're going to see deep cuts to Medicaid, to Medicare, maybe Social Security, investments in education, public investments in infrastructure, research, health are going to fall by the wayside.
The CBO's report also warns that as millions of baby boomers retire over the next decade, the drain on Medicare will become unsustainable. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Across the country, cuts to education are threatening programs and services. Texas school officials say arts and culture programs could get hit after lawmakers approved a $4 billion drop in public education funding. And in Los Angeles, the city's long-running adult education program, which serves many from the city's immigrant and low-income communities, could be virtually wiped out if a current budget proposal is approved. But the cuts are also prompting action. In New York, high school students have called for a citywide walkout today to protest the latest round of school closings and budget cuts. Community News Production Institute reporter Jessel Knorr visited some of the schools taking part and brings us this report.
New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg made fixing the city's school system a central goal of his administration. A central tactic of this goal is closing so-called failing schools. Backed by federal mandates, over the past decade, he's closed more than 100 schools and opened more than 500 new ones, including 100 charter schools. Among the two dozen schools set to close after this school year is Manhattan's Legacy High. It has a 43% four-year graduation rate, making it a failing school in the eye of the city. But 17-year-old senior Kayla Marte disagrees with that designation.
They should look at themselves. Like, they're pointing one finger at us, but they have four pointing right back at them. Like, it's an unfair ball game, and we're not failures, and I'm here to say that I'm not a failure.
Many education activists strongly oppose the policy of closing down schools. Those targeted for closure, such as Legacy, serve low-income students of color. Others serve large numbers of students learning English. These same schools have also been hit hard by budget cuts. According to the Alliance for Quality Education, $1.3 billion in cuts in 2011 meant a reduction in spending of more than $800 per student in poor districts. In wealthy districts, the cut was about $270. Students, including Legacy senior Marte, says the city's policies of closing schools is misguided, and they organized the walkout to send a message that other solutions are possible.
We're kind of risking it all because with walking out, our message is not to cut school. Our message is bigger, like this is our education. So the same fact that you want us to learn, we want to learn and we have the right to learn, but you not giving us a chance just fails us just as much as us walking out of school does. And that's the bigger picture.
Marte has reached out to a dozen other schools, including Brooklyn's Paul Robeson High. Last year, students and teachers there lost an intense battle to stop their school from being phased out. When Robeson reopened in the fall, did not have an incoming freshman class. Instead, two new schools were opened inside the same building. Robeson's remaining staff and funding were reduced.
And then when they had voted to close the school, you noticed a lot of things disappearing in a way. Like, a lot of my high school years, my future was disappearing with it. I soon realized.
17-year-old Robeson senior Kaylin Burton, who's participating in the walkout with other classmates, says closing schools limits students' opportunities.
It affected me, like, it changed my whole perspective on where I thought I would, what I wanted to do with myself after high school. I felt like my options were very limited after a while. I mean, I came into the school for science and technology, and now I'm in a business class.
Why?
Because they don't have science or technology anymore.
Reduced budgets also means fewer teachers at Robeson.
We strongly believe that to close a school is to destroy a community, and it has destroyed our community.
Stephanie Siegel, who began teaching English at Robeson in 1991, is among the remaining educators at the school.
It's been horrific. I mean, the first faculty meeting we had in September, I just surprised myself and broke down and cried through the whole thing. And just the realization to walk into a situation where there used to be, you know, 80-plus staff members, and we were down to 18.
Opposition to closing schools has been growing in New York. On Tuesday, several potential mayoral candidates vying to replace Mayor Bloomberg denounced the policy at City Hall. But while local opposition is growing, the Obama administration is demanding school districts accelerate such policies or risk losing federal funding. In his State of the City address last month, Mayor Bloomberg said he would risk losing these funds. He said 33 schools would be put in a turnaround program in which ineffective teachers are fired. Some are concerned those schools will be quickly shuttered, while the mayor focuses on his goal of opening 50 new charter schools. Wednesday's walkout is a preview of the actions planned for next week, when New York's Department of Education is scheduled to vote on closing more schools, including Legacy. Organizers with groups such as Occupy the DOE says they'll prevent that vote from happening by any means necessary. Jessel Noor, FSRN, New York.
This week, activists in Southern California are drawing attention to what they call secret negotiations taking place for a free trade deal shaping up in the Asia-Pacific region. The Trans-Pacific Free Trade Agreement could affect policies in Malaysia, Australia, Peru, Vietnam, the United States, and other countries with vast implications for labor, the environment, and public health. FSRN sat down with Tim Robertson in downtown Los Angeles. He's the director of the California Free Trade Coalition. Tim Robertson, welcome to FSRN.
Thanks for having me.
First, tell us about these negotiations taking place in Los Angeles. Who is participating and what is on the table?
Well, you mentioned all the countries, so trade negotiators from all of those countries are meeting in Los Angeles and San Diego this week, rather quietly, to discuss some of the more specific issues around this Trans-Pacific Free Trade Agreement. They're going to be talking about intellectual property issues, labor protections, environmental protections, rules of origins, and a couple other of the more specific issues.
And let's get into some of those issues. According to the Obama administration's Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, the talks have now achieved broad outlines of an agreement, which include, quote, industrial goods, agriculture, and textiles, as well as rules on intellectual property, technical barriers to trade, labor, and environment. What are your primary concerns?
Well, they talk a lot about these commercial issues, you know, lowering tariffs and industrial goods exchange. But when you really look at these deals, you find a broad swath of corporate handouts. When they talk about intellectual property, we're talking about things like big pharmaceutical companies getting negotiating extensions in their patents. When we look and follow this down the rabbit hole, we find that it's making it harder and harder for people who have AIDS or tuberculosis in some of these developing countries or low-income communities here in the United States to have access to, generic medications. All of this is so that, they can continue selling their top-line, newly patented, slightly formulated versions of AIDS medications and make the most money possible, which is actually a death sentence to a lot of these people in developing communities that have, these very manageable diseases.
Well, talk about that more for a moment, how this could affect access to affordable medication in these developing countries and what impact that could have on people's public health.
Well, among the 600 corporate advisors that are at the table have access to these negotiations, in contrast to the very few people from civil society who do, are a lot of high-paid corporate lobbyists from the big pharmaceutical companies. There's a lot from, big agricultural companies, big manufacturing firms, and the Chamber of Commerce. They're all at the table having their say. And what they're doing is using each of these chapters, the intellectual property chapter, labor standards, rules of origin, to kind of manipulate the system, to take power away from our government, our elected officials, and to just tweak the rules so that so that they can win on this large corporate scale and make a little bit more money. What we're concerned about is the fact that I mentioned that civil society, members of Congress, members of the media like yourself, have very little access to these negotiations to fight for workers and to make sure that these corporate interests don't totally outweigh the voices and the interests of people.
We're talking about global scale here and regional players and how this could affect many different people across the globe, but let's bring it to a local level here. How could a deal like this affect workers or communities in California?
It's a great question. You know, we know from NAFTA and previous free trade agreements that these deals cost jobs. You know, there's direct evidence that NAFTA alone cost 700,000 American jobs. And we've seen, along with NAFTA and China joining the WTO, we've seen over 6 million manufacturing jobs nationwide disappear just this century in the last 10 years. That's one in three manufacturing jobs. You know, we've seen kind of the way these deals work as a, you know, kind of offshoring mechanism. And when we're looking at some of the countries involved, Vietnam, Malaysia, a lot of people are thinking that these are going to be low-cost alternatives to China as some workers there start to you know, get a little bit more of a voice on the workplace. And you know, that's very terrifying from a not only a American jobs perspective, but from a human rights perspective. These deals put downward pressure on wages here and around the world, and human rights. And you know, these corporations that are in these negotiations are looking for ways to save money. And if that means going somewhere where labor standards are cheaper and we can't use these kind of agreements to raise such standards, then it's not going to be helpful for anyone except for the very, very 1%, if you will, that will be making money off of these deals.
Lately, there's been lots of attention on anti-piracy measures. In Europe, there's the ACTA, and in the U.S., the Stop Online Piracy Act, or SOPA. They've been criticized for threatening freedom of expression and online innovation. This deal is set to protect digital technologies. According to the Obama administration, it says that it will protect U.S. company interests. If this deal were to move forward in its current form, how could it affect digital information?
It absolutely could. A lot of people are seeing the intellectual property chapter of this to be something like a SOPA 2.0. Just everything that negotiators wanted in ACTA but couldn't actually get. And the questions of whether or not internet freedoms are being challenged are very real. And as we learn more and more about the negotiations, we see that that's a really realistic threat, and we're concerned about that. It's just one more reason that we're trying to make sure people are aware of this and make sure that we can put pressure on the negotiators from both the national negotiators and the corporate lobbyists who are there pressing for these kind of provisions. So.
Tim Robertson is the director of the California Free Trade Coalition. He spoke to us about negotiations taking place in Los Angeles on the Trans-Pacific Free Trade Agreement. Tim Robertson, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
In the Philippines, officials continue the country's first ever impeachment trial of the chief judge of the Supreme Court. Renato Corona faces a number of charges, including failure to disclose assets, blocking the investigation against former President Gloria Arroyo for electoral fraud, and misuse of a multi-million dollar World Bank loan. The trial has riveted the country with demonstrations both in support of and against impeachment. Some activists have used a technique that may be familiar in the U.S. They've set up a tent near the Senate, and they're pressing for an end to corruption and for integrity of the judicial process. FSRN's Madonna Varola reports.
In Pasay City, a parade of vehicles carrying impeachment signs drives around the Senate building. Nearby is a makeshift prayer tent where activists for truth and justice are fasting day and night. Anabella Dionela is president of ACAPCA, a 27-year-old movement for active nonviolence in the country.
For me, impeachment is a venue where a person could be given a fair trial because both parties are being heard. And so it connects with our belief in nonviolence, that each person should be given a fair trial, and that even he is already judged by the people, but still, we value the dignity of every human person.
In December, 188 of the 284 members of the House of Representatives voted to impeach Supreme Court Chief Justice Renato Corona. He was charged with 8 articles of impeachment, including being partial and subservient to the former Gloria Macapagal Arroyo administration, failing to disclose assets and committing graft and corruption. He's also accused of blocking the administration's campaign promise to make former President Arroyo accountable for alleged corruption. Arroyo appointed Corona to the Supreme Court shortly before she finished her term in office, and some lawmakers questioned the legality of the appointment.
Well,
This is the first time that the justice is being impeached in the country. Congressmember Elpidio Barzaga is among the prosecutors.
It is our position that the Chief Justice no longer possess that integrity, that perception to the public that he can administer this justice. And our position is backed up by so many factors. Based on the surveys conducted in the Philippines, among the top five officials, the lowest public approval rating happens to be the Chief Justice.
But Corona has denied the allegations and has refused to resign from his post. He told his supporters that there is a conspiracy to remove him so President Benigno Aquino can install a justice more favorable to the current administration. He denied accusations of irregularities in the use of a $21 million U.S. loaned by the World Bank to the Supreme Court, which was intended for judicial reforms. Karen Jimeno is a spokesperson for Corona.
Not even all the congressmen who filed the verified complaint for impeachment even read the complaint. There are jurisprudence saying that if you have an unverified complaint, the effect of that is that it's an unsigned pleading and all proceedings that are subsequent to the filing of that complaint are null and void. Nevertheless, we proceeded with the trial. And then now with the trial, they violated the rules of pleading and the basic rights of due process of the accused to be informed of the charges against him. They allege in Article 2 that his only offense there was his failure to publicly disclose his statement of assets and liabilities. But after proving that, now they're alleging that he has accumulated ill-gotten wealth when they did not clearly state that in their verified complaint.
The media has covered the case closely, including raising questions about Corona's expensive properties, which some say he could not afford in a Chief Justice's salary. Political satirist May Paner has been monitoring the trial.
So while there's a small room in here that is working on the process, there's a bigger audience out there. And thanks to the work of media, opinions are being formed. When the voice of the people is not represented, and the people whom they feel are the ones who are causing the present corrupt system to continue and to pervade, then of course people will have to do something. People will go out again. People will protest.
Back at the prayer tent, community volunteer Ophelia Nilo Caser says she hopes a trial will get to the truth and justice will prevail.
I wish Justice Corona would be honest to admit if he had wronged people. Let us remember that he is still a person who experiences hurts, including his family. He still has the right to be respected.
The impeachment trial is expected to last from 3 to 6 months. If he's convicted, Corona could be removed from office. Madonna Virola, FSRN, Manila.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Ellis Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Etter and Zane Carisley. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening today in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina.